So if you remember right, when we looked at, I mean, it seems like it's been forever since we've been here. We had a couple Wednesdays there that were abnormal, I guess. But well, Bob spoke, so it was one normal one. And then last week we helped the Barkers get on the way there. But if you remember, we said that chapter 17 was the hinge that between two sections of Scripture in Leviticus, one that contained the ritual regulation of public life and worship, and the second portion, 18 through 25, was the regulating personal and private affairs of individuals. But this chapter here gets into more, or elaborates on more of the moral and ceremonial law. And you'll find in here many occasions that the phrase, "I am the Lord," several times, actually, I think there's 15 times that the Lord would use that phrase in there. And I think, as the Israelites need it, we need it, don't we? That we need to be reminded that He's God. I think in the busyness of things, in the stress of life, the bottom line is that we need the reminder as we walk in this world that He's Lord. You know, that nothing else really matters that is of any worth, you know. And Bob asked me tonight how I was doing at work, because I had a stretch there that was testing, you know. And I said, the Lord's taught me how to deal with it, you know. He teaches us how to persevere through it all, right? And He teaches us that He is God, and He is above all things. Anything compared to God is nothing, right? I mean, we just can't compare anything to Him and say, this is God, right? I mean, a lot of us will say, we'll look at the heavens sometimes. You ever look out when you're out in the dark, and you look up and you see the heavens, and you see the wonderful stars that the Lord had placed there by the span of His hand. And we see all that and we go, wow, that's the Lord, you know. But even the heavens don't describe the Lord very well, you know. Even though He's the creator of them, we are birthed in His image, and yet we don't describe Him. We are His prized possession, not the stars, not the earth, not anything else, but we are it for Him. And yet we don't describe Him very well, you know. And I think the challenge for our lives as Christians, as lovers of God, is that our lives are a reflection of Him, is a reflection of His Son. That's the challenge for us, is that you know, we remember that He is God. He is far above anyone's reflection of Him. You know what I mean? And I think we need that reminder. We talked about chapter 18 and 20, how there is a certain order here to these chapters. And no doubt marriage is the forerunner of all of them. Marriage seems to be the cornerstone, and it certainly, if you go back in Genesis, the union between the man and the wife was first. The kids were not first in the family. You know, the husband and the wife was the first thing. Of course, nowadays we seem to have that out of order, you know, and it's not to our benefit. It's really, as we see marriage take a second seat in society, we see chaos, we see immorality, you know. We see just the running wildness of folks, you know. Just chaotic. We see that today in our society. Why is that? Well, they've taken I want to say they've taken marriage right out of it, right? Marriage, if you ask, you go do your own survey and ask people how important marriage is to them. What do you think you're gonna get from them? It's not very important to them. They don't see the benefit in it, but it was the first relationship, human relationship that God would create. You know, and it's something that God ordained. Now we've seen not only marriage take the second seat, but now we've perverted marriage into something that it really isn't. And it's sad. It should bring us, in a sense, to tears, you know. And I think as we look at these verses tonight, we'll see that sin, God addresses addresses Israel with these moral laws so that they can have a holy relationship. It's about the relationship that we have with the Lord. Remember, the last time we spoke, it was the last portion of chapter 18. We're reminded of how God would warn Israel of the dangers of accepting and adopting the Canaanite practices. And if they did, there was suffering involved. There was a consequence involved, right? And as we look at these, see, we don't see these things in the same light as we did back then, or God saw them. So the question is, who changed? God and His principles and His laws? Or did we change? You know? Who draws farther away, God or man? You know, who's the one that taints the relationship that a person has with God? And it is us. Interesting, we had a conversation around the dinner table tonight about capital punishment, and I won't get into that. But some of the feelings that are involved in that. See, it's not about feelings. It's about what does God say about it that should affect us. It's not about what I feel is the correct thing. It's about what God feels is correct. Why? Because ultimately, He is ultimate righteousness. He is ultimate holiness. I am not. I don't have the right to think, in a sense, those moral laws for myself. I need instruction from the Lord. You know, and so many times do we try to rationalize why we believe what we believe because of our feelings. And that's not walking in faith. That's walking in rebellion. Right? If we start to say, God, I don't understand that and I won't believe it. I don't like that. Right? Remember, God would say that to the Israelites that if they followed after the Canaanites, that the land would even revolt against them. It would vomit them out of the land. And we did see that in Israel's history, as we saw them follow after false gods and whatnot, and they're just in the flesh, you know, that God would vomit them out of the land for a while. And then he would graciously bring them back into the land. And we see prophecy there fulfilled as well. Romans 8:22 would say, "For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now." The Lord would command them not to follow after the ways of the Canaanite, not to be the party pooper, but to, for their own good, right? I mean, doesn't God give us rules for our own good? as we walk by faith, I think we got to believe that, hey, you know, He did this because He loved us. He saw this as to be the best thing for us. So let's start reading here in chapter 19, verse 1. And it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say to them, You shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and his father, and keep my Sabbath. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols, nor make yourselves molded gods. I am the Lord your God. And if you offer a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, you shall offer it of your own free will. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it. And on the next day, if any remains until the third day, it shall be burned in the fire. And if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an abomination. It shall not be accepted. Therefore, every one who eats it shall bear his iniquity, because he has profaned the hollow offering of the Lord. And that person shall be cut off from his people. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of the field, nor shall you gather the gleaning of your harvest." Meaning you shouldn't go through it a second time. "And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God." So that very first opening here of this chapter, Moses is told to go speak to the children of Israel, to the congregation there. "You shall be holy, for I am holy." See, the only way we can be holy is that if we spend time with the Lord. Because on our own account, we cannot be holy. So in that phrase there, in that sentence that the Lord would give us, it is implied that we can be holy because God's holy. But it also implies that we spend time with Him. When we look at Leviticus, we see that Leviticus is just full of holiness of the Lord. Secondly, after God says that we should be holy as He is, He would encourage them to revere their mother and their father and keep the Sabbath. Holiness is followed by honoring your parents. Right? You can see that there is a structure here. There is a flow here. The flow is that God is holy. Therefore, I can be holy. Right? There's that holiness of God. And then God would refer to the relationship that a child would have to the parent, the honoring there. Scripture would say revere, that we should revere. And that really means fearing God. And so, what's God saying? I've put them in charge. I've put them in charge from an earthly standpoint. So a child, whether he or she is young or whether she is old, or he's old, there is an expectation here from the Lord that there would be reverence given to their parents, a respect, that honoring of the parents that would be given. And I will say that in this, there is no condition of what the parent has to look like. Okay? That God doesn't say, well, if your parent acts obedient to me, revere him, revere her. It's a command to the child to do it. It's out of obedience. I don't always take pleasure in it, perhaps, but there is a level of holiness for that child that they're missing out on by not revering that parent. And when reverence of parents don't take place, guess what we get? We get exactly what we get today in our world. How many of you are tired of seeing kids in the supermarket yelling at their parents? Do you see that at Wise? I mean, you see it where parents are dogs, are treated like dogs by their children. And it shouldn't be. That's the decay. See, the first problem is that they don't want to have holiness with their God. They don't want to have the holiness of their God. And then, because of that, see, the honoring of the parent isn't there as well. And we really see a decay in our society. And unfortunately, you know, there's no reverence for God anymore either. You'd be surprised how many kids and teenagers that if you ask them about Jesus would know very little about him. It used to be that everybody went to church, that everybody learned about the Lord. We might have not accepted him, but we went there. Right? There was a certain fear of the Lord. But today's kids barely have knowledge of him. I think it's important that we teach our kids about the Lord. So in the same fashion as the child should revere the parent, I think the parent should also portray the Lord in holiness, right? If we're going to give the next generation of kids this legacy of the Lord, we need to be following the Lord in our actions. So as honor our parents are our human duties, keeping the Sabbath or honoring the Lord is our first step towards holiness. Because if you think about the Sabbath, so in that verse he says, and keep my Sabbath, I am the Lord your God. For the Jewish people, it was sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday. But for us, see, who is the Sabbath? Jesus is the Sabbath. Right? And we are supposed to, he's supposed to be our Sabbath every day of the week. Right? Not just Sundays. We should be in that Sabbath rest every day of the week because of our relationship with him. And throughout all this, there stands a reminder at both the end of verse 3 and the end of verse 4, I am the Lord your God. Remember that. And do not turn to idols. Right? Do not turn to idols. And sometimes when we think of idols, we think of idols as something that we carved out or something like that. But for us, see, it's not that obvious. For us, it's almost so subtle that we think that we don't have idols now. Right? And I almost feel like, you know, back then, God would say, look it, don't turn to idols, nor make yourselves molded gods. See, for us, See, for them, they made their gods. They would make them with their own hands. For us, see, we buy our gods. Not that some of them didn't probably buy them, but I think it's a little less subtle. Or it's so subtle today. Like, you know, what do you consider your idol in your life? And I think we all can, if we sat long enough, we'd think of one at least in our lives that kind of rule us, you know. I think of the video games for the kids nowadays. I'm like, oh, ready to break every single device there is on earth. I hate them with a passion. Just to let you know how I feel. I do not like video games. I don't. My kids do play them. However, there's limits to them. And I think they're a waste of time. You know what idol means? It means to be weak. To be weak. Or some define it as nothing. Absolutely nothing. That's what it is. It's nothing. You know, it just wastes our time. And a lot of times they would worship these idols for financial benefit, right? It wasn't like they cared about that thing there. They were hoping that if they worshiped them, that they would benefit. They would have some kind of benefit from that, right? Financially or health-wise or in the world, you know, a blessing kind of thing. But yeah, absolutely nothing. In Israel, this isn't something that Israel had an issue with and God confronted them with. Let's be honest, you know, God probably mentioned this in here because they were struggling with it. And he knew that they would struggle with it. And so God mentions these things for our benefits as well. Israel would struggle with idols for over 800 years. Before their Babylonian captivity took place. And it distracted them from the holiness of God. So we see here so far the call to holiness, the command to honor the parents. And we discussed, hey, we don't see this today, and it's because of the lack of holiness. It's the lack of desire to be with the Lord, to be holy, to honor the Sabbath, because the Sabbath really reflects Jesus. He is our Sabbath rest. We need to honor him daily and not just a one-day-a-week stop. Not turning to idols or creating them, because we have a tendency, right, to want to have something tangible in our hands. But when it comes down to it, when it all comes down to it, really the thing that's going to make the difference in our life is not what we possess, but it's that relationship with the Lord, that drawing into holiness. Holiness is going to be the one determining factor of our success. Right? You're not going to be able to pull up some, you know, maybe none of us will be, our lives will be recorded in encyclopedia or history books or anything like that. But true success in God's eyes is holiness. And we only experience that in our relationship with him. What does holiness mean? Holiness means that we are separated. We are separated for his purpose. We are separated from this world. We're not a part of this world. We're aliens. And some of us even look like we're aliens. Right? But our desire should be there. Verses 5 through 8 covers the sacrifice of the peace offering, which is prescribed to the layman or the general man, rather than in chapter 7, we'd covered that for the priesthood. This one seems a little less complicated. You know, in the peace offering, was given. And we compared this peace offering when we studied it with the communion that we have today. And so it's really when a man would offer a peace offering, what was he saying? He was saying, here's my desire, Lord. My desire is to have peace with you, Lord. I want peace with you, Lord. And I want true fellowship with you, Lord. And he wasn't doing it because, you know, Dad said, go apologize to Johnny, right? You know, have you ever done that with your kids? Taking them, that was bad, Jonathan. Go apologize to Peter, right? Isn't it great when you see your kid go, Peter, I'm sorry. Isn't it? When you see your kid actually desire to do that right thing. And I think that's what God is saying here, is that I don't want this to be a coercion on my part. I want this to be free will. And it does say that in there. In the bottom part of verse 5, it says, and if you offer a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, you shall offer it of your own free will. So it should be up to you. It should be totally up to you. And then it mentions that if, you know, it goes through and it says, if you have this bread, which you, you know, the offering which you can partake in, if it's there 2 days, fine. But if it's there the third day, you better get rid of it because it's a stale then. You know, have you ever eaten a piece of the communion? Have you ever eaten a piece of the communion and said, man, this must have been laying out for a week? I have here. I have taken one of them crackers and I felt like somebody just dunked it in some of the water and it was like soggy almost. It was stale, right? Kind of you chew it to get it down and hopefully the juice helps, right? Right? But, you know, it's stale. And God says, I don't want a stale relationship with you. I don't want a stale fellowship with you. I want this crisp fellowship with my kids. And that's something that I hope that all of us desires. Then in verse 9, it's kind of interesting because in this whole section of Scripture, it kind of jumps in and out of topics, you know. But here's one that I've always liked. I always thought this was pretty neat. When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field. What is he saying there? You shall purposely not reap those corners. There should be purpose in it. It's kind of a neat thing that God would set up, in a sense, the first welfare system that's biblical. And probably the only one that's biblical. Because today we hand people things just to hand them things, right? But God was providing a way for the widows, for the orphans, for those that were in misfortunate situations, to be able to eat. And so God would say, I want you to leave that there for them. Remember Ruth? That's how she met Boaz, right? Because of his kindness, because of his generosity there. And remember what he did. He gave even more than the corners, didn't he? He kind of piled it up for her. Pretty neat thing. I always loved the story up north where we were. We had a mailman. He was a great guy. He was a man of God, and he had this ministry called the Gleaning Ministry. And they would go out every fall in October, and they would glean the fields. And then they would take them down into Geneva, and they would just give them to people, you know. And then if somebody, they found somebody that was, their family was hurting, he'd say, come with us. Come with us. You can glean with us. They'd go out to the farmers' fields. And up there, if you've ever been through there, it's like, that's all crop farming, you know. So a lot of pumpkins, squash, cabbage, you name it, right? You name it, any of that fallish fruit or fallish veggies are up there in the fields. And they'd take them, and they would get a lot of, believe it or not, you know, because when them harvesters go through, they don't care if they leave one pumpkin, right? They could care less. It costs more to turn the rig around and pick it up than it does to leave it there, in a sense. But they would get good fruit for these people. So that was pretty neat, and I always remember that. Verse 11. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. And you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane my name, for of your God I am the Lord. You shall not cheat your neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. You shall not curse the deaf, nor shall you put a stumbling block before the blind, but shall fear your God. I am the Lord. You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among the people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the children of the people, of your people. But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So speaking of being good neighbors, always considering their neighbors, he was encouraging here. Not necessarily the person that lives next door. Often people would think that was the case, but it was more than that. It was everybody that was in their midst, everybody that they came in contact with. A good question is, how do we treat others? Verse 12 says, you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your Lord, of your God. You should be honest. God's saying, don't you dare use my name in a situation where you're not being honest. Don't say it's of the Lord and then be dishonest. Always be honest. And that's a challenge, right? That's a challenge even for us Christians, right? To be honest in all situations. Finding a 20 on the ground that you saw drop out of somebody's pocket, right? Turning around and giving it to them is a challenge. Especially if you don't have a 20 even in your pocket. Right? But God, you know, the holiness, how important is holiness to us? That's what we have to ask. How important is it to honor the Lord? Is it worth it? And then the Lord in verses 13 and 14 would have something to say about exploiting people. Using people, using the weaker vessels, in a sense. Our 11 through 12 may have forbidden crooked dealings between people that kind of were equal, right? But these verses seem to indicate that exploiting those in a weaker state was even more, perhaps, vicious. You know, that was the next rung on the ladder. For instance, a deaf person, if you were to say a curse against a deaf person, they couldn't even hear the curse. You know? You shall not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block in front of the blind. It's just a nasty thing to do, in a sense. Then it speaks about keeping the wage of the neighbor, cheating the neighbor or robbing. It says, the wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. Pay the person when they're done doing their thing for you. Perhaps that wage would inflict hardship on them. And with the heart that is seeking after God's holiness, right, God says, give them what you owe them. So that they're not bound by in this hardship, that they don't have to experience it. And of course, Scripture would say a laborer is worth his wages. Verse 15 says, You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial. Justice here speaks of the righteous judgment. And that we shouldn't be partial. We shouldn't have sympathy for the poor if the poor has done wrong. Yet we shouldn't respect those that are mighty if they've done wrong. We should treat them with equal judgment. Then it talks about talebearing, because these communities would live rather close. Folks would know each other well. Stories would be told. That stuff would be coming into the justice system, and it would be told, and they would be judged accordingly on these false witnesses. For us, I think, our challenge is gossip. I don't know what it is about it, but one of the biggest things I would say at Elmira Christian that we're dealing with and they're dealing with is gossip amongst the kids. You know? Very hurtful gossip. My kids will come home and say, Dad, so-and-so is saying this about so-and-so. I say, well, what are you going to do about it? I'm going to the principal. That's our rule. You know, hey, if you hear gossip, man, go tell the principal. Go tell the administrator. You know? Let's take care of this. Let's nip it. You know? And I think that is one of the biggest challenges, I think, for Christians within the church. Hey, you know, I've had guys when I was an elder at Finger Lakes, hey, have you seen Brother So-and-so? Say, nope, I haven't. Or, yes, I have. They said, is he okay? I said, yeah, absolutely okay. Is something wrong? Possibly. Well, what is it so I can pray for it? You don't need to know what it is. You just need to pray. Because what happens there is gossip starts coming out. You know, I was teaching the kids up in Children's Church here a couple weeks ago, right? And we were talking about this whole gossip thing, you know, and how it's hurtful. And we played that game, you know, you whisper in this kid's ear and he goes around. They call it telephone, you know, and you go around and around and sure enough it gets back to you and it is nothing. I did find a source of the problem. It was Jonathan. Every time it got to Jonathan, somehow the code was cracked. It was funny. He would get laughing so much I think he couldn't hear the words being... Okay. But it's hurtful, isn't it? I mean, maybe you've experienced it yourself where somebody said something about you that's not very true, and maybe there's partial truths in it, but they didn't get the whole story. And it's hurtful. But Jesus would remind us in chapter 7, right, when he was telling his disciples up on the mount, he would say, "Judge not, that you be not judged." So make sure that you, for with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. Right? And with the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. It's if we're going to judge somebody, judge them by the correct measure, because it could, Jesus says that same measure should be used against you as well. So, what is it talking about? Fairness in judgment. Right? To be fair. And then in verse 17, it would talk about the hatred there. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. Hatred in our hearts for our brothers need to be rectified, right? We need to straighten it out. And if we don't, it can be very damaging. Damaging to our relationship, damaging to somebody else's relationship, can just be damaging. Sometimes we even get annoyed at people, right? We just need to take it to our brother, and we need to take it to our sister and straighten it out. It's foolishness sitting back in the back pew and not doing something. Not that I'm saying that it's with you guys, right? No, but it's foolishness to sit back and just churn it, right? How many times have we sat and just churned something about a brother or a sister and just said, "They're driving me nuts, and they're so annoying with this," and da da da. Instead of confronting him, you know, Abraham did that with Abimelech, right, in Genesis, where he didn't like how Abimelech's servants were doing things, so he went to Abimelech and he confronted him about it. We need to handle it right, right? Proverbs 27:5 says, "Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed." We don't like that verse often. Sometimes we don't like the open rebuke, right? Proverbs 9, verse 8 says, "Rebuke a wise man, and he will love you." So it shows us when we get rebuked how wise we are. If we're really, truly the wise man there who loves the rebuke. Of course, Matthew 18:15-22 would talk about confronting our brother. The right way to confront our brother and our sister. Right? In love. Right? Because, let's face it, this is the reason why we rebuke our brothers, to bring them back on the right track. Right? Not onto our track, but onto the Lord's track, right? So often do we go, "Well, that's not the way I would do it." And we rebuke them, "Man, you shouldn't do it that way because I wouldn't do it that way." But the Lord's saying, "Let's get them on my track. I want back in fellowship with this brother or sister," you know? And so this confrontation, and I've got a good story about this that I won't share, but I've got a good personal story that happened to me in Matthew 18 when I was in ministry at Finger Lakes in children's ministry, and it was real to me, you know, that I had to do this, right? And I was the one having it done to me, right? What I didn't realize is my actions hurt somebody. And I would have never realized it if my brother didn't come to me and tell me about it. But I think I was the wise man that said, "You know what? I'm glad you rebuked me on this one." Right? It's important. Are we seeking after? See, this is the thing. When somebody rebukes us and we get a little, you know, have a little issue with it. Say, what are we after here? Are we after holiness? Do we want to be holy as the Lord's holy? Because if we do, we might get a little, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck might have stood up, or my ears might have got red at first, but After a while, you know, you come back and say, you know, they were right on this one. I need to step back from this. Galatians 6 says, brethren, if a brother overtakes in any trespass, he who are spiritually restored, such as the one in a spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, consider yourself lest you also be tempted. So in gentleness, you go to somebody, you confront them in a spirit of gentleness. You want to restore them. I always said to the guys that when I was a supervisor, I had this one guy. Me and him, we just didn't get along very well. He was always, he knew I was a Christian, and often he would use it against me. You know, because he would get me flustered, and I would yell at him and whatnot. And he would say, "What kind of Christian are you?" And that even made me more mad, right? And I remember one day I was standing there, and he came up to me, and he started yelling at me. And so I yelled back at him. And so the storm settled after a while. He came back to me at one point and started talking to me in a decent tone, you know. And I said to him, you know, if you put a gun in somebody's face, usually there is a reaction behind it, right? If you put a gun in my face, I'm going to defend. And that's what I did with him. He would put the gun in my face by yelling at me. And so I'd pull out my gun and yell at him, you know. Did it accomplish anything? It really didn't, you know, it really didn't. And it was years before I could actually have a decent relationship with this guy. But it's something for me, you know, with my kids. I realize that sometimes I just need to have that gentle approach. You know, it's not always easy. You get frustrated at people or at kids, but a gentle response, that spirit of gentleness, they'll consider what you're going to say. But I think the one thing that the Lord is trying to show us here is that we need to approach these situations in love. I mean, he would even tell us in Luke to love our enemies, to do good to them who hate you. Well, how do you know somebody hates you? Usually they do evil to you, right? They do something bad to you. But God says, no, I want you to turn around and do something good to them. It's not conditional. I love how the Lord in verse 18 would top it off here as he's talking about not having vengeance against them or having any grudges there. And it says, but you shall love your neighbor. And he doesn't quit with that. He says, you should love your neighbor as yourself. As yourself. Which implies that we should take care of others as if we were taking care of ourselves. What does that mean? That means we give them what we want to be given to us. Even though they don't give that to us, they could possibly not even give that to us, right? What our desires are. But we should always give somebody else what we would have them give us. I think that's holiness. You know, the one thing we don't have a problem doing is loving ourselves. We know what makes us happy. We know how to love others because we know how to love ourselves. Right? God's given us easy instructions here. You know how to love yourself. Love others like that. You know? Ephesians 5:29 says this. It says, "For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourished and cherished it, just as the Lord does the church." See, the Lord knows how He wants to be treated. So you know what He does? He treats the church that same way. He cherishes them. He feeds them. He nourishes them. Paul would say in Timothy, 2 Timothy 3:2, he would say, "For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." Be lovers of themselves. He knew that men would do this, right? Why does God give us this instruction here? Because He knew men would do as Paul would say in 2 Timothy. Verse 19. "You shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with any others. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed. Nor shall a garment of mixed linen or wool come upon you. Whoever lies carnally with a woman who is betrothed to a man as a concubine, and who has not at all been redeemed, nor given her freedom, for this there shall be scourging or punishment, consequence. But they shall not be put to death, because she is not free. And he shall bring his trespass offering to the Lord, to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, a ram as a trespass offering. The priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering before the Lord, for his sin which he has committed. And the sin which he has committed shall be forgiven. When you come into the land and have planted all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as uncircumcised. 3 years it shall be as uncircumcised to you. It shall not be eaten. But in the fourth year, all its fruit shall be holy, a praise to the Lord. In the fifth year, you may eat its fruit, that it may yield to you its increase. I am the Lord your God." So this transition here between loving your neighbor and not mixed breeding here, or no mixed breeding, seems a little crazy, or maybe a little strange. However, in Israel, both these aspects, the loving of the neighbor and the not mixing breeds, were aspects of holiness, and you can find that highlighted in Leviticus 11. The animal kingdom mirrored the human world, clean versus unclean, and for Israel and the other nations. So when we think about this mixed breeding, God is once again calling out holiness. He wants His people to be separated. If you think of Genesis, when God, right from the beginning, created heaven and earth, He created light and darkness. Right? There was light, and it was separated there from darkness. And God would separate His people from the other nations for His own possession, as well as for holiness' sake, to maintain holiness. he would instruct Abraham and others to not intermarry with the Canaanites. Right? Why was that? It was so that there wouldn't be the holiness wouldn't be jeopardized. I read somewhere that the mixed seeds were different species of livestock, and the seeds and the fabric was usually seen by pagans to have some sort of magical power, and God was saying, Israel, I want you to stay out of that kind of thing. I don't want you to. And later on here, he warns them about the sorcerers and the mediums and all that stuff. So God wanted them to be a separate people for their own good. Then in verse 20 there, another strange insert here. However, this concubine, or it would be a slave girl, it would define her as not being free. Therefore, she was considered a foreigner. Therefore, it may be the mixing of difference in the sense of the kind here. So you've got the Israelite, and you have the slave girl. And God said, it says, whoever lies carnally with a woman who is betrothed to a man, meaning that she was engaged to a man, right? And this fellow would have sex with this betrothed girl who is betrothed by somebody else, it wasn't considered here to be adultery. And there was seemingly some law here that would state an exception, because we know that adultery was considered to be penalized by death, right? So in this case, they weren't to be put to death. And the reason for the exemption is stated in verse 20. And it says, because she was not free. Because she was a slave. The law didn't apply to her. Or her seducer, for that matter. The penalty imposed here was on the man, and he would have to give a trespass offering in order to atone for the sin that he has committed. Verse 25 says in 23, when you come into the land, this is God's ultimate goal for Israel, is to take them into the land. They would not be able to partake in the fruit. He would have them plant fruit trees. And then they wouldn't be able to partake in that fruit tree. It was uncircumcised. It was grown out of that land. Until the fifth year, they would be able to eat from that. The harvested fruit during that time period was probably a benefit. It was a benefit because it allowed the trees to multiply. It allowed them to have an increase that would supply their needs for the harvest and longevity of the nation. It would allow them to have fruit from them fruit trees for a while. And then the Lord would, in 26 here, the law to separate from the other pagan practices And it would go on in verse 26 to say, "You shall not eat anything with blood, nor shall you practice divination or soothsaying. You shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor shall you disfigure the edge of your beard. You shall not make any cutting in your flesh for the dead, nor tattoo any marks on you. I am the Lord. Do not prostitute your daughter, to cause her to be a harlot, lest the land fall in harlotry, and the land become full of wickedness. You shall keep my Sabbath and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Give no regard to mediums and familiar spirits. Do not seek after them to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God." So God was concerned here with the defilement of His people, that they would get into the practice of the pagans that were in the land. You might remember in where it says there, not shave around the sides of your head. And you've probably seen the Orthodox Jewish men, the Hasidic Jews there, that would have untrimmed beards and them long, curly locks that go down the sides of their head. And this is probably where they get that from. Verse 28, "You shall not make any cutting of your flesh for the dead, nor tattoos." They were to differentiate themselves from the world. These things that are mentioned here were something that was done of the pagan. We got to be careful that we don't get caught up in things that the pagan does and then somehow Christianize them into a Christian practice. And there's many of those things we can probably sit here and think about. You know, I think about all the Easter eggs that we do every year, right? I don't do them. But Christians do them. Then we take them and we provide resurrection eggs. You know, and the Lord, I think that's just taking that little pagan belief in a sense and putting our Christian ease to it. And we kind of make it okay with that. But God, I think, has a higher calling for us. He wants us to differentiate ourselves from the world. Just because they do it doesn't mean we have to do it. In Paul's day in the city of Corinth, only prostitutes went around without head covering. So for the Christian women in Corinth, they had covering. Today, we don't have covering on our heads. Our women don't. Some do. Some still practice that. But it's not the same, see. Our prostitutes don't. I don't know. It's not, you know, if you're looked at without head covering, you're not all of a sudden you're a prostitute, right? Today, that's not what is put on a woman, right, without her head covering. So it's not necessary for today. This here in verse 29 where it says, "Do not prostitute your daughters," it's speaking probably of a ritual, giving in to a ritual, selling your daughter per se to a pagan ritual. So what is he saying here? Don't sell your kids to these pagan beliefs. Don't commit your kids to these pagan beliefs. Make sure your kids are focused on the Lord. And then it goes on to say, "You shall keep my Sabbath and reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Give no regards to Medians, or these would be those that were seeking after the dead, talking to the dead. Don't give in to that foolishness. Then it would end the chapter here in verse 32 with more encouragements of kindness. You shall arise before the gray-headed and honor the presence of an old man and fear your God. I am the Lord. And if a stranger dwells with you in your land, you shall not mistreat him. The stranger who dwells among you shall be to you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. What is he saying? I loved you when you were a stranger. You shall do no injustice in judgment, in measurement of length, weight, or volume. No cheating. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, and honest Ephraim, and you shall in an honest hin. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe all my statutes and all my judgments and perform them. I am the Lord. So he ends this chapter with fair treatment to all, no matter who they are, whether they're strangers in the land or not. He finishes the chapter with the one statement that is found in almost half the verses in this chapter, I am the Lord. And I like to point out is that it's present tense. It's not he was the Lord, but he is. I am the Lord. You know, it's present tense. And it speaks of the reason why the Lord would give these laws to Israel. This is his character. He is his holy character.